I am Rabbi Avi Killip, and welcome to Responsa Radio. I am sitting here with Rabbi Ethan Tucker.
Thanks. Great to be here with you.
Rabbi Tucker, tell us a little bit about yourself and about Machon Hadar.
My name is Ethan Tucker, and I'm Rosh Yeshiva at Machon Hadar in New York. Machon Hadar is an institution of higher Jewish learning. We're based in New York City, but we are blessed with students both in person and online, all around the country, all around the world. One of the things that we founded Hadar to do was to be a place for really substantive, deep engagement with Jewish learning, and particular around questions of Jewish law and practice. So the conversations that we'll be having in the context of Responsa Radio are really aimed to advance that goal.
I know that one of the things that you do frequently is alumni of Yeshivat Hadar will write to you with halachic questions, which is part of what gave us the idea for why we needed this kind of a radio show. So what we did is we reached out to the alumni of Yeshivat Hadar, students who had learned here previously, and we invited them to submit questions, halachic questions, that they wanted us to address in this podcast. So this is our chance to discuss these questions a little bit and give some answers. So this is a question from someone who identifies themselves as Night Owl Davener. This question is about prayer times for people with alternative schedules. Say I work a night shift, or I am a college student, or for whatever reason, I have a schedule that makes it unrealistic, unhealthy, or even just inconvenient to be awake during any of the times allotted for Shachrit, which is the morning service. Would I daven Shachrit? Would I pray that morning service when I get up? Or make sure to get up in the middle of my sleeping hours to, perhaps exhaustedly, pray? Or at least say the Shema at the right time? Or should I wait until Mincha, the afternoon service, you know, acknowledging that this is less than ideal, but this is my long-term situation?
Yeah, well, I wish this person a better schedule in their life than they currently have. That's my main initial response. But let's respond to the conditions as they are. As a kind of overarching comment here, I would say, the laws of prayer of tefillah are anchored in two things. They're anchored in a certain kind of personal experience of waking and the times at which people wake up and go to sleep, but they're also very much anchored in astronomy and in God's world and the rhythms that it has independent of human beings, and, you know, the ways in which the overwhelming majority of human beings function in that world, which is to be awake during the day and asleep at night. You can see the first piece, the ways in which the times for tefillah are responsive to human society, in one of the earliest debates in the Mishnah, in Tractate Brachot, where Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua are arguing over the end time for the Shema. And Rabbi Eliezer basically says, you know, it's more or less a dawn, you know, essentially. From when it gets light, you've got until sunrise, and that's pretty much it. Rabbi Yoshua says, no, you've got until about 9 a.m., 3 hours into the day or so, because that's the time when B'nai Melachim, royalty, get up. In other words, he's looking around and he's essentially saying, let me find, you know, the laziest, latest risers in our society.
Royalty and college students.
Royalty and college students, we might translate. And those people, on some level, give me my terminus ad quem, to use a fancy Latin term, the end time past which I can't say the Shema. Now, that on some level is also responding to the biblical directive of b'shochbecha, when you lie down, uvekumecha, when you get up. And Rabbi Yoshua is saying, well, let's see when people get up, and that'll be the end time for the Shema. Now, there's an interesting kind of meta question, which is, are we living now in a time post the ubiquitousness of electricity that we've actually reconfigured the times of human waking? And if Rabbi Yoshua were alive today, he would in fact say, no, the biblical standard of the deadline for the Shema has moved now. It's later. Maybe. Part of me feels like maybe within limits, but I still don't think even Rabbi Yoshua would say that 2 p.m. would be an appropriate time for saying the morning Shema, for two reasons. One, it's ultimately not the time when most people get up. And even if royalty were not most people in his day, they were a prominent and indicative part of the society, even if as an aristocratic elite. But also there is here an astronomical factor of day and night that I think no one ever imagined gets completely upended.
I think we'd say the same thing, that someone who now wakes up at 2 in the afternoon, they're not calling it morning either.
Right. So it may be the time of their waking, but for Tfilat Shacharit, which is the name itself evokes the notion of the dawn, of Shachar, it's at that point just sort of too far removed. So look, I think in terms of practical guidance here, what you've got to say is this. The times for prayer, those are the times. Those are the fixed times, and they don't vary based on the idiosyncratic patterns of a minority group of the population. That said, an individual person who is unable, for whatever reason, that's not just gross negligence or nonchalance, to make a certain time of prayer, may be and ought to be recognized as being in the category of anus, as subject to circumstances that are not totally under their control, or perhaps a little more mildly, unable to sustain the kind of minimal kavanah, intention, and direction required for prayer, and therefore either are exempt from prayer at that time, or expected, as the questioner hints at, to make it up at the next prayer. As the black letter law is that when a person accidentally or under duress or on account of illness misses the morning prayer, when they get to the time for mincha in the afternoon, they are supposed to then actually do the Amidah, do that central prayer twice in order to make up for the one at Shachri. So if I were giving this person practical guidance, I would say, yeah, if you can structure your sleep schedule such that you can wake up or be awake, let's say that, be awake at least for at some point between dawn and the 9 a.m. slot when the Shema needs to be completed by, and it's not exactly 9 a.m., it varies by the seasons, a person should certainly do that. If one misses that time, then by around 10 a.m. or so, it's still totally fine without any question to say all the parts of the morning davening. And there's strong support all the way up until astronomical noon for saying all the normal parts of the morning davening. So at least anyone who can at least get up before noon should pray as regular, no different from anyone else. And to the extent they're going to sleep past noon, but they were at least up through the night until dawn, then they should pray those morning prayers and then go back to sleep. For the rare instance of someone, they're on some kind of medical shift or something of that sort, where let's say the only time they can sleep is basically between 4 a.m. and 1 p.m., and they feel that setting their alarm to go off is going to just have all kinds of other horrible consequences, I think there's ground in that case to say that that person is, for reasons out of their control, exempt from davening shachrit, or if not exempt, sort of charitably understood why they did not do shachrit in that morning interval. And when they get up in the afternoon, they should say all the blessings that are normally said upon awaking, Birchot HaShachar, etc. This is a kind of question where someone who really wants the guidance blow by blow could be in touch with me or consult with some sources that I can give with them. But that's the big picture.
Okay, I want to move to a much more abstract question about a concept called Karov LaMalchut. So I want to ask you to start by giving us a little bit of a definition of the concept of Karov LaMalchut, and then I will give you the question relating to that.
Great. So as background on this, the Torah at one point says, Velo telchu b'chukot hagoy. Do not follow the ways of the nations that I am going to bring you into their land. And the context of that verse, there's a lot of argument over what it means exactly in the Bible, but at least one of the meanings that Chazal, the classical sages, give to it is the notion that Jews are supposed to be distinctive, in their culture, and particularly in their appearance and presentation in all kinds of ways. There is a notion that Jews should not try to speak exactly like Gentiles, should not try to look exactly like Gentiles, and in other ways there should be kind of boundaries between the two cultures. Obviously, a lot of questions as to how that translates into the contemporary world. And for many Jews, that's actually just totally, even right, observant Jews who are rigorous in all kinds of details of halakha, that notion is far into their thinking and to their practice. But the background to Karov LaMalchut is that there is such a category. A Karov LaMalchut, literally one who is close to the government, is a category of people who are identified in these early sources as getting a dispensation with respect to those restrictions. That is to say, in classic terms, I think what we're talking about here is the court Jew who needs to be positioned in certain Gentile contexts as an effective interlocutor for the Jewish people, as an effective presence for whatever their role is in that Gentile government. That person will often need to master Greek language, Greek philosophy in ancient times, will need to style their hair in a certain way that doesn't stand out. And so it creates this kind of fascinating category of people who, by dint of their association with the government, are allowed leniencies with respect to certain laws that other Jews are not.
The question that we've been given is, with that understanding of Karov LaMalchut as a historic concept, how far does that doctrine extend into modern society? It goes on to say, you know, on the one hand, where Jews are more prominent than ever in leadership, on the other hand, there are many facets of society that are more tolerant of our maybe esoteric religious practices that maybe used to be practices that really differentiated Jews. In a lot of ways, you could say it's much easier for an observant Jew to take on a leadership role in the government now than ever was the case before. Do we want to translate that concept to today? And if we do, how would we even go about that?
Great. So there's a lot more to say here, but I think it's a fantastic question, which really hits the nail on the head as in terms of what we have to struggle with here. In particular, living as a Jew in contemporary democratic and multicultural America really forces this question to the fore. I want to just share a little quote from Alexis de Tocqueville, who a long time back already reflected on the ways in which the United States, and in some ways all democracies, are very different. And he writes as follows: "Thus far I have examined the institutions of the United States. I have passed their legislation in review and have described the present forms of political society in that country. But above these institutions, and beyond all these characteristic forms, there is a sovereign power, that of the people, which may destroy or modify them at its pleasure. The people are therefore the real directing power. And although the form of government is representative, it is evident that the opinions, the prejudices, the interests, and even the passions of the people are hindered by no permanent obstacles from exercising a perpetual influence on the daily conduct of affairs." Now, a lot of people involved in contemporary campaign finance law and reform might doubt whether some of these observations by de Tocqueville still apply, but de Tocqueville is getting at something, which is that in democracy, and in many ways, even still today, in very strong form, in American democracy, it's a deep sense in which the government is your next-door neighbor. And that argues for, in fact, much more expansive thinking about the application of Karov LaMalchut. If this category was, in its essence, about enabling Jews to effectively have their interests represented, have the kind of social networks that they needed to have in order to effectively interact with the government and the society in which they lived. The fact is, in a contemporary democracy, one of the ways that that happens is by being interwoven with the concerns and relationships of the citizenry at large. And for all the challenges that presents for Jewish distinctiveness, I think that is one of the strong impulses that many Jews living in America have about why they don't want too many insuperable boundaries between them and their neighbors, which is they feel they're signed onto a shared political and social project with their neighbors, and therefore they actually need to be able, within some limits, to blend in with them and to share certain kinds of social spaces with them. So there is something there, I think, to be sort of explored. I think we stand on the frontier of that question, with Jews being as integrated into contemporary society as they are. But the questioner also hits on the reverse piece, which is looking at a lot of the precedents around Krovei Malchut, those who were close to the government, a lot of them were clearly dispensations given because it was felt it was necessary to give them those dispensations in order to be who they needed to be. One of the blessings of being in a multicultural society is that people don't have to hide their slightly offbeat hairstyles, religious practices, maybe leather straps that they bind themselves in every morning, or any number of other things that we can point to. They don't have to hide them in order to be effective members of the society. You know, I think about this all the time in terms of, you know, you're in an airport and the question of putting on tefillin or otherwise sort of obviously demonstrative religious garb in that kind of public space. Even in my own life, I feel like as a kid, I felt like that was something kind of very odd or very demonstrative and very weird. Now there's a lot of me that feels like I am nowhere near the weirdest guy in the airport in terms of the kinds of things that people will do and how they dress and how they present. This is one of those answers where I actually think the halachic language around this category is tremendously useful for opening up the conversation. And it's very hard to arrive at hard and fast answers. In 2014, the halakha is X. Here's what Krovei Malchut applies to.
Right. So in some senses, you gave us two different ways to think about it. One is, it could be potentially that we are all today Karov LeMalchut. And on the other side, it could be that none of us are Karov LeMalchut because none of us need
that.
That's
exactly right. That's exactly right.
Another question, which also is going to hit on some of these similar themes, in that it's a question about how do we separate ourselves from a Gentile community. And I'm going to give a little bit of background before this question. So it used to be that if I made myself a new bowl, I could just go ahead and start using that bowl. I didn't have to bring that bowl to the mikveh in order to make it kosher. But if I acquire a bowl from someone who is a not Jewish person, then I am required to bring that bowl first to the mikveh. We'll call it toiveling the bowl, with the English ending to toivel, toiveling the bowl, in order to then use that bowl. So the question that we're being asked now is, today, when most dishes and utensils that we own and used to eat are mass-produced and sold by large companies, does the mitzvah of tevilat kelim, of bringing your dishes to the mikveh before using them, still hold?
Yeah, it's a great question. So let me just add a word to your introduction, which is the whole notion of tevilat kelim, of immersing utensils in the mikveh. First of all, I think one of the things that's interesting in the contemporary American Jewish community is that for many people, that category and that practice is like mother's milk. It's something they did as a child, and it was just sort of an essential piece of what it meant to keep kosher and maintain a kosher home. And then there's other people who otherwise grew up in, you know, observant environments, and certainly those for whom observance may have been something I encountered later in life, for whom they might not even have ever heard of it. And that reflects actually some of the struggle of where this category plays out in the contemporary world. In terms of its scope, just to clarify first, I think it's important to note we're dealing here with bowls or utensils of the sort that are used for food, and only that, meaning this was never a category that applied to a bookcase or to other pieces of furniture. It really is very much part of the complex of regulations that are surrounding food regulations, and in particular in this case, some of the ways in which food is used as a boundary between Jews and Gentiles to create a certain distance that will enable Jews to maintain distinctiveness. And that's the background for thinking about this. So yeah, the question here is really asking, taking as a given for a moment the framework of these halachot, these laws, which assumes that something purchased from a Jew is not subject to this requirement, but something purchased from a Gentile is, how do we deal with something purchased from Sears? right? Like, how do we think about something that's purchased from a third-party corporate entity, which not only will I never meet the artisan who made it, but also, on some level, the artisan who made it never owned it. And the question of whether, as a corporation, anyone as a person ever owned it, or if the whole legal structure of a corporation and its limited liability is essentially a kind of trust of the regulatory state that distributes profits to different people who are signed on the incorporating documents, but it's not really about them and their personal assets. And the key there really then rests on, do we think that it is purchasing something from a Jew that exempts something from being immersed in a mikvah? Or is it that it being owned by a specific individual Gentile triggers the obligation to do so? And the corporation really makes us focus on that middle case of it is neither really a Jew nor a Gentile as to what we're after. So here, I think everyone has acknowledged in one way or another that a corporation is somewhat different from an individual. The question has been, how so? So you've had many contemporary rabbinic authorities who have said, yeah, unless you can show, let's say, for instance, Rav Moshe Feinstein, one of the prominent, you know, leading 20th century American Pesik. Rav Moshe Feinstein said, essentially, a corporation is defined by its controlling interest. So if the controlling interest is a Jewish family of a given corporation, then you can treat an object bought from that corporation as if you purchased it from a Jew. But otherwise, you'll need to immerse that vessel, say a blessing, and all the laws will apply.
So does he imagine that you're actually finding out who owns every corporation that you're buying from?
I think he probably assumes in the United States, and when you buy things from China and other places like that, that for the most part, the default assumption is you're dealing with a Gentile corporation. And therefore, that would mean when you buy something from Sears and other places like that, you still immerse it, and it's subject to all the same restrictions. But Rav Moshe Feinstein actually in other places writes, and this is, you know, he writes in general about corporations, not about the immersing of vessels in that way. And another place where he's writing about the laws of charging interest and the question of whether the biblical prohibition on interest applies to a corporation, he actually argues that, well, it doesn't seem that a corporation has the status of a person, and therefore, there might not be any restriction around interest in the context of various kinds of corporate deals and loans, etc. So, interestingly enough, based on that approach, two different people, or two different institutions in a way, commented on this question coming out a very different way. One of them was Rav Herschel Schechter at Yeshiva University, who's one of the prominent contemporary voices in American Orthodoxy. And he, it's said in his name orally, that he holds that really based on taking that structure of the corporation seriously, truth be told, there should be no obligation in Tevilat Kelim in immersing vessels in any kind of contemporary corporate context. And therefore, he says, even if the practice is to immerse the vessels, and suggesting seemingly that we shouldn't necessarily try to stamp out that practice, what we should say is that people should not say a blessing when they immerse those vessels in a mikvah, because they really don't have to be immersed. We do it as a kind of way of continuing a tradition of what we've done and responding to a community that is largely still doing that practice. He says, I want that marker made clear by not making a blessing. In a similar vein, and in a way I'm sure Rav Schechter was unaware of, and maybe he would have formulated differently were he aware of it, the Conservative Movement's Law Committee also passed a responsum, a little more aggressively adopting this logic, also based on one of Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuvot, his responsa, saying, no, There's no obligation to do it whatsoever anymore. They responding, I think, a little more to a community where people have not really been immersing their vessels, was not just saying don't make a blessing, but said there's no need to do it. And if someone insists on doing it in a certain kind of context, well, then certainly they shouldn't make a blessing. But they're actually both playing with this notion that it's different when you're dealing with a corporation. I would try to sort of see the wisdom that lies between those two approaches, which is to say, I think when thinking about this question, I would not tell someone to not go and do Tevilat Kelim and to tell them, stop doing this practice. I think there's an educational value also to having uses of the mikvah that people can kind of connect to in various kinds of ways. I think there's something powerful about bringing your children to a mikvah, having them see it as part of the landscape and architecture of Jewish life, and doing that with the vessels that they will eat off of is a very powerful way to do that. But I do think the lenient position around the corporation's view is a very important one for enabling us to be much more generous towards those in the contemporary world that for any number of reasons are not immersing their vessels, and we therefore don't have to necessarily see that behavior as deviant or departing from what halakha would demand, but it's one response, totally legitimate response, to dealing with a new economic and social reality.
Great. So you've given us a lot of good background and ideology in both directions. Do you actually take your devices that you buy from Sears to the mikveh?
Yeah, so I do. The ones that are at least made of metal and glass, which are the only ones that are subject, you know, like plates and ceramics and all that are also not subject. It's really only things that can be sort of like melted down and made into something new. That has its whole interesting history to it. But I do that and have on many occasions brought my children along. I've actually struggled with whether I feel I should say a blessing, because there's part of me that really does fully buy the corporation's argument and does feel like I'm doing this almost as an anthropological religious act more than a religious obligation. And yet, part of what confers there being some feeling of sanctity around the act is, of course, invoking God's name and saying, I'm fulfilling your commandments. And I'm not sure I'm sold either on the notion that that's really taking God's name in vain to say that blessing at that moment, even if on some level it's an elective usage of that blessing. And that's a whole other broader question we could get into.
One last question. This question was submitted from someone who is a theater student. So she's asking a question about how theater and Shabbat come together. So she asks, to what extent, if any, one can perform on Shabbat, assuming there's no direct desecration of Shabbat? So then she goes on to say, for instance, let's say there's no microphones on the person. Maybe they're hanging from the stage or they're around the room. Maybe you put your makeup and got dressed everything before Shabbat. So what should she be thinking about in terms of that question of can she perform on Shabbat when it doesn't feel like there's any direct malacha happening?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's a big question. It has dimensions that relate to how do we fulfill Shabbat in its environment, and it has dimensions that really relate to how do we understand Jews in the professions and in modern society, and are there whole areas and fields that Jewish observance in line with halakha precludes a person from being a part of or not? Again, to quote Rav Moshe Feinstein, he has a fascinating responsum where essentially someone comes and asks him whether he can be an actor in this play on Shabbat, if he can have the Gentile staff that's working on the production apply cold cream to his face on Friday night after he's finished the production in order to remove the makeup from his face, which he understands to be a kind of prohibition of Shabbat for him to do himself, but maybe someone else can do it for him and it'll be okay. And before responding to the question in great detail, which Rav Moshe does and actually offers a lenient answer, he starts out with this kind of shocked paragraph of describing, I don't really understand where this question is coming from. What would someone who cares about Shabbat be doing in the theater? Because the entire culture of the theater is one of frivolity, profanity, inappropriate sexuality, violence. Rav Moshe essentially says, you can't go to a play or a movie and not encounter one of those problematic, offensive themes. What's a nice Jewish boy doing in this production? What's amazing about this response is after getting that off his chest, he comes back and essentially says, yeah, if you do it in this way, it's okay to have the cold cream put on your face. But I think there is that frame, and I think something we always have to ask ourselves is, what is our bias with respect to the given profession we're talking about, right? I think it's taken for granted in the Jewish community that it's a good thing to be a doctor. And therefore, the only questions we have about Jews and being doctors on Shabbat is how do they do it and what are the limits, but not whether they should do it. Does the same apply to being a public elected official in a Gentile government in America? I think so, but not everyone does. Does the same thing apply to being an astronaut? I think so. I'm not sure everyone else does, et cetera, et cetera. And we could probably all get to some other unsavory professions where wider circles of us might feel comfortable saying, no, that's not really what a Torah-influenced person should be doing. Here I would just point to an interesting Gemara in Ta'anit, where there's a fascinating scene between a sage and Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, kind of appearing and taking this person out for a tour of the marketplace to show them who in the crowded marketplace merits the world to come. And Eliyahu brings this sage over to these two people and says, you see those people? They have a place in the world to come. He asks them, a sage asks these two people, what do you do? And they say, we're clowns. And he says, what do you mean? Like, what do you do? And why do you merit the world to come? And they say, well, when we see sad people, we go over and we make them laugh. And that passage in the Talmud is actually amazing because it does say something about the role of the potential role. I emphasize that the potential role of performance art leading to a certain state of emotional health and emotional healing that gives that profession or that acting the potential of being something that is extremely important. So I would say there's a lot of parts of the sort of performance industry that I look upon with a very jaundiced eye. I mean, I don't have a television at home, and there's a lot of things in mass culture I wouldn't want to expose my kids to. But I also have a tremendous appreciation for when done right and with the right intention and in the right context, it can be very positive. So with that frame in mind, that I think that's at least possible, then I think you can get into the questions here and some of what Rav Moshe Feinstein raises in terms of the ways in which, yeah, if you're in a non-technical Shabbat violation space, I don't think the notion of acting itself or performance itself is a problem. And in fact, that happens all the time, right? Jewish a cappella groups perform for Jewish audiences on Shabbat all the time. And there's no reason intrinsically why being in a theater from that perspective is any different. The real issues that come up here are around commerce. Right, and really about the people who are buying tickets, the profit that is accruing to the actors, when it's assuming it's not a volunteer production, and the ways in which you are contributing on some level to an environment in which people have to work on Shabbat. Now, here's where I think there is a big difference between doing this in a majority Gentile context as opposed to, let's say, in the context of the State of Israel, where you've got a Jewish performance troupe, for the most part, that's doing it for a paying on Shabbat Jewish audience. To the extent it's a majority of Jews, the approach is basically to say a Jew can't go in and benefit and be a part of that enterprise because they're essentially about an enterprise that is undermining the way the milacha and economic structure around Shabbat is supposed to work. But if this is essentially a Gentile institution, then for a Jew to essentially be a minor player in that, as long as they're not violating anything themselves, is okay. So I think from the audience perspective, that's the metric I would use to think about that, which would make it, maybe ironically, but maybe not so, less problematic to perform on Friday night in Times Square than in the Bima on Tel Aviv. So that's sort of that piece. On the profit angle, you know, there's interesting history to this too. There was always a question of how can you pay rabbis and chazanim on Shabbat? These people in their own way are doing a certain kind of performance, and they're being paid, and it's happening on Shabbat. The general approach with that and other kinds of work is that work that could be understood to be folded in to a larger set of obligations, the majority of which apply during the week and not on Shabbat, or at least some of which apply during the week and not on Shabbat, a person can consider the money that they earn to essentially be a lump sum that they're being paid for the weekday time.
So let's say you do eight shows a week and two of them are on Shabbat.
Exactly. There's a plausible case there that they are not paying you to work on Shabbat. They're paying you to do this show. And it turns out that one of the dates is on Shabbat. I mean, obviously, anything having to do with the handling of money or receiving of a check or anything like that, that would be totally out and unacceptable in the context of Shabbat.
I wanted to ask a follow-up question. You talked about how, for Rav Moshe Feinstein, the question of whether or not this was a worthy profession was relevant to the question of the Malacha on Shabbat. And I'm wondering if those feel connected for you.
Yeah, they do feel connected. And I'll give you a kind of further meta halacha reflection on this. My motivation, personally, with engaging these questions or with finding someone a way to work through an issue like this is very much tapped into, do I see there being some underlying value to this person finding their path through this profession? I'm not interested in halakha in order to get around it or to get around the obstacles of it. I'm interested in it because I think it provides important and core guidance to how we should live as Jews and human beings. And so therefore, if I'm trying to find what's that right path, what does God want from me or anyone else in this situation, a key piece of that is figuring out some sense of, does it feel like God would want this person to go down this path at all? And that's where I think, I guess another dimension I would add to these kinds of questions is, and here I'm really not speaking in terms of, you know, with the hat of you know, someone speaking from halacha as a posek. I'm really speaking just more sort of as a Jew thinking this through. There are different phases in life and different phases in being in a profession. And I think everyone who's had any kind of progression through a profession understands that there are certain things you need to do at an earlier phase in order to get to a later phase. You can't just become a United States senator overnight. You have to have slogged through a whole bunch of more local politics in order to get there. And the kinds of things that you have leeway to do at a later point in time, in terms of calling the shots as a famous, influential person, you may have less leeway with as a kind of first-year staffer on Capitol Hill, who is just getting your feet wet and essentially is the go-to person to dump all sorts of things on. And because there's that progression, it's even more important to kind of determine, do you feel there is some value to people ending up at that end point where they are the influential, successful person in that profession, in albeit in a dominated Gentile, general, non-Jewish society? And once you do, if you do think there's a positive value there, you do think there's a positive value to those clowns in the marketplace being able to cheer people up, then you got to find a way, a pathway that you get to that end point. Now, that doesn't mean that in order to enable someone to succeed as an actor or a politician, you warrant them breaking the law. But it does mean that you may be prepared to essentially have workarounds that don't violate things technically in order to get to a place later on that you feel is infused with value. And I would say you ought to feel that, because if you don't feel it'll be infused with value at the end, then you've just been trying to outsmart God and sort of end run around the halakha as opposed to figure out where is it attempting to guide you and direct you.
Great. Thanks. I want to thank you for your time today and your time researching and thinking about these questions before today. And I look forward to our next conversation on our next podcast. If you have halachic questions that you would like answered on this show in the future, you can send an email with your question to halacha@machonhadar.org, H-A-L-A-K-H-A-H at machonhadar, M-E-C-H-O-N-H-A-D-A-R.org. And your question could be answered on the air. Responsa Radio is a production of Open Quorum.
I enjoyed it.
That was great. Okay.
Thank you.
See how it goes.